I'm very grateful, ladies and gentlemen, for the kind words spoken of me by the Vice Chancellor. Lawyers among you will have noted that he was not on oath. I was glad to hear him say that I was a distinguished advocate of the 20th century. I was waiting for him to come to the 21st century, but he didn't. However, I shall make do as best I can with what encomiums I've had. I have once before been in this hall. I didn't remember the noises which I'm told by the Vice Chancellor are birds. I had been afraid that they might have been premature expressions of disapproval of my speech. However, I'm not going to make a philosophical speech tonight. I'm going to talk on one subject. I've called my lecture Evil Under the Sun, which is a quotation from Ecclesiastes. It's about the death of Steve Biko. This is the 34th anniversary of the death of Stephen Bantu Biko. He was 30 years of age. I remember that I read of the death in the newspapers the following day. I'd never met him, and many, perhaps most white people in South Africa had never heard of him. I at least had heard of him as a militant young black leader who espoused the black consciousness philosophy. And I had heard reports from some of my colleagues at the bar that as a witness in a defense, as a witness for the defense at the trial in Pretoria of some young black activists, he had made a strong impression on an originally unsympathetic judge. That was all. So I must admit to having been astonished at the reaction to the news of Steve Biko's death. The bare facts, as they first came out, were that he'd been arrested for the breach of a banning order confining him to King Williamstown, that he'd been in the custody of the security branch of the South African police at Port Elizabeth, he'd become unwell, had been sent to Pretoria, and had died there in a prison cell. The reaction to his death was extraordinary. Steve Biko was not the first man to have died while in the custody of the security branch of the police. He was, as far as these things were known, the 44th. But his death was reported internationally. In Washington, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee called the death an outrage. In the United Nations, it was described as tragic. In South Africa, thousands of black students demonstrated. Desmond Tutu, then Bishop of Lesotho, expressed the sense of loss felt within this country. And Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi said, "Only a country as mad as South Africa could waste such talent." The sense of outrage was hardly dampened by the first response of the South African government. The Minister of Police, Mr. Jimmy Kruger, speaking in the congenial atmosphere of the Transvaal Congress of the Nationalist Party, stated that Biko had been on a hunger strike. One of the delegates, to the great amusement of his fellow delegates, congratulated Mr. Kruger for being so democratic that those who wanted to starve themselves to death were allowed by him to do so. Mr. Kruger then made his never-to-be-forgotten statement. "I'm not pleased," he said, "I'm not sorry. Biko's death leaves me cold." There was, of course, no truth at all in the story of a hunger strike. The wave of protest and condemnation did not die down, and international pressure forced the Prime Minister, Mr. Forster, to promise a full inquiry. It took the form of an inquest, which opened 2 months later in Pretoria in the old synagogue, a deconsecrated building converted into a courtroom some years before, especially to accommodate major political trials. The chief magistrate presided at the inquest. There were several sets of advocates engaged for the police, for the district surgeons, and for the prisons department. There were three of us representing the Biko family, more particularly the mother and the widow of Steve Biko. And I myself, George Bezos, and Ernie Wenzel appeared for them. Our instructing attorney was the lively and efficient Shen Chetty. Ernie Wenzel and Chetty are no longer with us. George Bezos is, and I'm very glad that he's here this evening. And I'm also very glad that Mrs. Biko, the widow of Steve Biko, could be here too. We were well prepared for the inquest. We had been given all the many affidavits made by the members of the Port Elizabeth Security Branch and also by the district surgeons who had seen Steve Biko. Further, the government pathologist had agreed that two pathologists who'd been engaged on behalf of the Biko family could observe and participate in the autopsy, which was carried out on the day after Steve Biko's death. The two pathologists were Dr. Jonathan Gluckman and Professor Neville Proctor, an internationally known neuropathologist. The inquest began on the 14th of November 1977 and ran for 2 weeks. I don't propose to try and tell the full story of the inquest. George Bezos has given a masterly account of it in his book with the title of No One to Blame. The inquest was very widely and on the whole very well reported in the South African press and in many South African newspapers. I suppose at this distance of time, no one will take it amiss if I mention particularly the brilliant reporting of the inquest in the Rand Daily Mail. The reports were by an extraordinarily competent court reporter named Helen Zillard. Whom I gather has now given up journalism in favor of some other occupation. Well, anyway, I'll try and give simply the essentials of the inquest and of what came to light there. The bare fact, Steve Biko was arrested at a roadblock on the 18th of August. It's believed that he'd been to Cape Town to visit political supporters. He was taken to Port Elizabeth Prison and kept there until the 6th of September. On that day, he was transferred to the headquarters of the security branch in Port Elizabeth, in a Port Elizabeth office building. He was held there under Section 6 of the Terrorism Act for interrogation. There'd been some inflammatory leaflets distributed in the eastern province, and the security police presumably believed that he was responsible for them. In any event, they were anxious to induce him to admit some connection with them. No such connection was ever proved, and those who knew Steve Biko best always disputed it. At all events, he was interrogated on the 6th of September, but he did not tell the police anything that they wanted to hear. On that day, He was a healthy man, indeed a strong man. On the morning of the 7th, he was seriously ill. He showed obvious signs of neurological damage. But he was never hospitalized. On the night of the 12th of September, he was sent to Pretoria prison, and by the morning he was dead. There was never any doubt, even before the inquest began, of the true cause of death. The story of a hunger strike was simply a clumsy fabrication. The cause of death was extensive brain damage caused by blows to the head. The pathologists, all of them, those employed by the state and those engaged by the Biko family, agreed on this. So what were the issues at the inquest? First, the police denied throughout that Biko had been assaulted. Consequently, much of the police evidence was directed to finding some cause for his brain injuries which did not incriminate them. The second issue was the manner in which Steve Biko was treated throughout his detention. On the first issue, there was a story to which all the officers adhered as best they could. On the morning of the 7th, this was the evidence, Biko was taken from the mat on which he'd lain under that night under guard and in shackles, and was taken to the investigation room. There he was seated on a chair, and when the major who was in charge of the investigation began to question him, he sprang up and attacked the major with such fury that it took a captain who was also present and three other officers to subdue him. In the course of this violent struggle, it was said, he must have bumped his head on the wall and fallen to the floor. But he was fighting furiously throughout. And after he was brought under control, he was taken back to the mat where he was again placed in leg irons. And the police maintained that this bump, this head bump against the wall, was the cause of all the brain injuries found post-mortem. Now, before the inquest, affidavits had been sworn by every person who'd had any contact with Biko during his detention. But unfortunately for the police, none of these affidavits, and there were 28 of them, had made any mention of the alleged bump on the head. Nor, it transpired, had any of the three doctors who examined Biko when he was in detention ever been told of any bump on the head. The security police colonel in command of Port Elizabeth, whose name has been mentioned by Mr. Nkosinati Biko this evening, but whom I shall not dignify by any name, he never mentioned this bump on the head to the doctors or in his affidavits. Further, the bump on the head version was utterly destroyed by the expert medical evidence. Professor Proctor, a world-renowned neuropathologist, as I've said, expressed the firm opinion that the brain injuries suffered by Biko must have resulted in a period of unconsciousness of at least 10 to 20 minutes. The same view was expressed by Dr. Gluckman, and these pathologists were supported in their view by a pathologist called, not by us, but by the other advocates, Professor Simpson, who was head of the Department of Anatomical Pathology at the University of Pretoria. He agreed. The state pathologist, Professor Lobster, did not dispute this. Yet the evidence of all the officers was that Biko fought, as one of them put it, like a wild animal throughout. Their evidence under cross-examination eliminated even the shortest period of unconsciousness. So it was demonstrably untrue that that thump on the head in this alleged scuffle could have caused the brain injury. Looking at these facts from what I hope is an objective distance, I have no doubt that between the evening of the 6th and the early morning of the 7th, Steve Biko suffered a number of heavy blows to the head, inflicted by one or more of the security branch officers who were in charge of him. The assault was probably carried out with some instrument which left no obvious external injury, such as, and here I must admit I'm guessing, such as a sandbag or a loaded length of hose pipe. The latter object was known from later evidence to have been used on other occasions by the security branch in Port Elizabeth. Many years later, as you've heard from Mr. Biko this evening, the Major made an application for amnesty to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was a strange application, ultimately, of course, rejected. Strange because he did not admit to any misdeed. But he did describe the instructions given to him by his superiors. They were told, he said, that we should break him down in order to obtain information from him. Steve Biko was hardly an easy man to break down. This was not his first experience of detention. One of his earlier spells of security branch detention had lasted 101 days, during which he had not yielded one inch to his interrogators. So the blows which caused his death was doubtlessly somebody's idea of breaking him down. Next, how was Steve Biko treated after he had received his injuries? He was stripped naked, his legs shackled and fixed to a grill, handcuffed most of the time. On that morning and that day of the 7th, he staggered, mumbled unintelligibly, did not take food or water, did not ask to go to the toilet. He was left lying on urine-stained blankets. The shackling and the nakedness were ordered by the colonel. When asked in cross-examination why he had given such orders, he replied that it was to prevent escape. When asked why, for decency's sake, this shackled man should not have been allowed to wear a pair of underpants, he replied that it was to prevent him from using them to commit suicide. This ludicrous answer was typical both of this officer's disregard for the truth and of his contempt for the most basic human rights of any person unfortunate enough to fall into his power. It was obvious, of course, to this colonel that there was something seriously wrong with Biko. He therefore, later on the 7th of September, sent for the district surgeon. The district surgeon arrived. This doctor said in his evidence that he had noticed Biko's slurred speech and staggering gait, and that the possibility of a head injury had occurred to him. But he asked no questions about a head injury, either of Biko himself or of the colonel. And he wrote out a certificate for the colonel stating simply, and nothing else, that he could find no evidence of any abnormality or pathology on Mr. Biko. And he left him lying as he found him. Why should an experienced district surgeon have been prepared to give such a misleading certificate? The answer became clear. The colonel had decided to take the line that Biko's slurred speech, his staggering, his incontinence were sham, put on in order to avoid interrogation, and he firmly turned the doctor's minds in that direction. He persisted even when the senior district surgeon who was called in the next day found a clinical sign that pointed strongly to neurological damage. The colonel still insisted that Biko was shamming, even after a consultant physician who had been called in by the senior district surgeon carried out a lumbar puncture which showed blood cells in the spinal fluid. This pretense was kept up by the police till the end. The physician recommended that Biko be kept under close observation in hospital. The colonel refused to allow this. Instead, Biko was sent to the sick bay in a local prison under the care only of a medical orderly. On the afternoon of the 11th September, there in the prison, he was found lying on the floor with froth on his mouth. He was described by the colonel himself as being in a semi-coma. At this stage, panic set in. The colonel remained unwilling to send him to a local hospital for reasons which one can guess quite easily, so it was decided to send him at once to Pretoria Central Prison. As no air ambulance was available, he was sent by road. He was placed on mats in the back of a Land Rover from which the rear seats had been removed. The captain was in charge. They drove 700 miles through the night. There was not even a medical orderly with them. Biko was kept naked throughout the journey. According to the captain, that was to make it harder for him to escape. No medical reports were brought to Pretoria. Instead, the Pretoria officials at the prison were falsely told that the Port Elizabeth doctors had found nothing wrong with Mr. Biko and that he was probably shamming. That afternoon, on the 12th of September, Steve Biko died, lying on a mat in the Pretoria Prison Hospital. At the inquest, we described it without, I think, any undue rhetorical exaggeration as a miserable and lonely death. The evidence at the inquest came to an end, and all counsel addressed the chief magistrate. The verdict came almost immediately on the morning after the inquest had ended, and it contained no reasons. It took about 3 minutes to deliver. The chief magistrate found that Stephen Bantu Biko had suffered extensive brain injuries, probably sustained during a scuffle with police officers on the morning of the 7th September, and that the evidence did not prove that the death was brought about by any act involving or amounting to an offence on the part of any person. So once again, the verdict was nobody was to blame. Given the history of previous inquests into the deaths of detainees, the verdict, perverse as it was by no means a surprise to us, by that I mean to counsel in the case. To quote Ecclesiastes again, "If thou seest the oppression of the poor and the violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter." But many did marvel. The verdict caused outrage in South Africa and well beyond. It flew in the face of all the evidence. Its formal result was to exonerate all the officers from the colonel downwards. They were not disciplined or even reprimanded for the manner in which they treated Biko after he'd suffered his injuries. On the contrary, the colonel was promoted to brigadier, and in due course so was the captain. In our closing address to the court, we said this: any verdict which can be seen as an exoneration of the Port Elizabeth security police will unfortunately be interpreted as a license to abuse helpless people with impunity. Unfortunately, we were right. Over the following 10 years, more than 30 people died while in detention by the security branch or having passed through their hands. So, what can we take from this lamentable tale of the unpunished killing of a particular man, a man of courage, of talents, and a man of promise who might have become a man of destiny in this country? What of the inquest itself? Well, it had at least exposed to the world, and more important to many in South Africa whose eyes, ears, and hearts had been closed, the cruelty and inhumanity inseparable from the regime of apartheid. It demonstrated that apartheid was not a social experiment which might or might not succeed, but was an exercise of power based only on force. The attitude of those who exercised that power was summed up in the comment which I quoted of the minister on Biko's death, and by the equally cold-hearted statements of the major and the colonel at the inquest. The major said that he felt bad when he heard about Biko's death. Why? Because he was worth much more to us alive than dead. The colonel said that he too was upset when he learnt of Biko's death, because, he said, it was a disaster for us that he could not be brought before court and unmasked. The present South African constitution has as its foundation the concept of Ubuntu. This word has been translated as a feeling of common humanity. Sometimes a concept can be defined by its opposite. The feelings expressed by the minister, the major, and the colonel are the exact opposite of Ubuntu. Now, these events, in the word of the poet, are old, unhappy, far-off things and battles long ago. Under the new constitution of South Africa, such things do not happen. But it may still be worth considering how they could have happened even under the old dispensation. The conduct which brought about the death of Steve Biko was, after all, completely unlawful. No statute in South Africa permitted murder or assault or deliberate medical neglect. There were laws which punished those things, and there were courts and lawyers. So how could such things have been done, and done with impunity? The simple and most direct answer is Section 6 of the Terrorism Act of 1967. Of course, long before that, existing statutes had given ministers huge and draconian powers over individuals and communities. But the difference in Section 6 of the Terrorism Act was that it put absolute power directly into the hands of the police. That section authorized the police, without judicial warrant, to arrest and detain any person whom any senior officer had reason to believe either had committed an offence under the Act or had knowledge of such an offence. The object of the detention was interrogation, and there was no limit to the period of detention. And the Act expressly provided that in that section that no court could order the release of a detainee. So habeas corpus was excluded. Moreover, a detainee was held incommunicado. He could not see or even write to a lawyer or a doctor of his own choice or members of his own family. Now, sometimes reports of assaults on detainees did somehow leak out, and applications for interdicts to stop abuse occasionally reached the courts. But the independence of the judiciary had been undermined by a policy of political appointments to the bench. In all too many cases, executive-minded judges, sympathetic to the objectives of the government, refused to intervene in cases concerning detainees. They were anxious, it seemed, only to ensure that court proceedings should not interfere with the interrogation process. So officers of the security branch who abused detainees knew that they had nothing to fear from their superiors and little from legal proceedings. That is why, writing about Biko's death, Alan Payton could say, "Any black who thinks he has a right equal to the white man to share equally in its government of South Africa will end up in detention. But there is a possibility more grave than that, the possibility that he may die there." Nor was it easy to publicize the treatment of detainees even after they were released. During those years in South Africa, the press was for the most part surprisingly free to criticize government action. However, the nationalist government passed an act which made it a criminal offense to publish any false statement about the police or about prisons unless the publisher could show that he had taken due care before publishing it. Now, that may not sound unreasonable. After all, it had to be proved the statement was false, and all the newspaper had to do was take reasonable care. But in effect, that was much further reaching than that. Because even if a newspaper had a sworn statement from an ex-detainee alleging assault or torture, it could be sure that it would be disputed in court by the security branch officers concerned, with every chance that some judicial equivalent of the Chief Magistrate of Pretoria would decide in favor of the officers. As to taking care before publishing, in the leading case under this statute, a case concerning the Rand Daily Mail and prisons, the judge had held that due care required a newspaper to give the authorities advance notice of the proposed publication and await their comments. The chilling effect on the press was inevitable, certainly once the Rand Daily Mail had been convicted. The facts about the treatment of Steve Biko could be safely published only because they were disclosed at a public inquest. Well, as I said, old unhappy, far-off things and battles long ago. Now South Africa has a constitution with a comprehensive Bill of Rights, which is enforced by the courts, and particularly the Constitutional Court of South Africa, undoubtedly one of the great successes of the new constitution. This constitution and this court are admired throughout the democratic world. 17 years ago, they established the rule of law in South Africa. Nonetheless, a glance around the modern world shows us that nowhere can the rule of law be taken for granted. In the United States, the 200-year-old Bill of Rights has not prevented Guantanamo Bay. Even in the United Kingdom, there are some politicians who talk seriously about repealing that country's Human Rights Act. The fact is that even in democracies, the concept and enforcement of human rights is often inconvenient and irritating to governments. Now, let me make it clear that I do not claim any special political expertise. But my belief is that in modern constitutional democracies, threats to the rule of law do not come so much from sweeping acts of legislation as from seemingly limited but incremental encroachments. I most certainly do not claim any qualification at this time to comment on South African politics. However, as a lawyer who over a long time, some would say too long a time, has practiced in different countries, I propose to venture with diffidence on a few very general observations. It is a truism that a free, independent, and critical press is essential to the rule of law, so I needn't labor that. But I would say that beware of any law which seeks to regulate the press. Statutory regulation, however reasonable it may look, will inevitably stifle both reporting and comment. And the apartheid-era press law, which I've mentioned, is a clear example. Still more dangerous would be any extension of the Official Secrets Act beyond its traditional scope of protecting military secrets which could be of use to an enemy. Once you have any more general definition of official secrets, you are going to inhibit legitimate investigative journalism. All governments have secrets everywhere, and they would all like to keep their secrets. But one must surely realize, particularly looking back at the apartheid era and at the Biko case, that an extension of the concept of government secrets, which may not be penetrated, will not merely inhibit investigative journalism, but can lead to situations, as the Biko case has shown us, where wrongdoers can act without the threat of exposure. No wrongdoer should ever be freed from the threat of exposure. I would also beware of any measure which even indirectly undermines the independence of the judiciary. Experience in many jurisdictions has shown that this undermining can take different forms. It may take the form of cutting down the jurisdiction of the courts, or it may take the form of appointments to the bench for political reasons or any reason other than merit. But let me be clear on one thing. One must not be too quick to characterize any controversial appointment to the bench as political. Diversity on the bench is a real benefit. It's of value and merit. And again, the question of merit itself is often a matter of opinion on which lawyers and other judges differ. All I would say is that the aim should always be to make merit the criterion. It's an aim not always attainable, but it should always be pursued. As we saw, under apartheid, the succession of judicial appointments undermined the respect for the judiciary as an institution. It was famously said by one of the drafters, one of the authors of the Constitution of the United States, that the judiciary in its nature is the weakest branch of government. Its power in the long run depends on its commanding the respect of society as a whole. Now, the courts are rightly open to public criticism. Judgments of the courts may legitimately be subjected to strong criticism, and even criticism which many of us would think unfair. That has to be accepted. Appointments to the bench, like any other acts of government, must also be open to reasoned criticism. But scurrilous and ill-founded attacks on the integrity and motives of the courts as a whole or of individual judges undermine respect for the judiciary and so undermine the rule of law. And such attacks should be deprecated by all Democrats, and the motives of those who make them should be viewed with the utmost suspicion. If I may say something else based on my own experience in other countries as well as this country, no government likes to lose a case in court. But recently, Lord Irvine, a former Lord Chancellor, said this, and he said it by way of criticism of politicians in his own party. He said, when a government wins a case, it is beneath its dignity to rejoice publicly. And when a government loses a case, it should be beneath its dignity to complain publicly. Well, that's the end of my sermon. Let me return to Steve Beaker. After the inquest, I read some of his writings for the first time, and I've recently reread some of them. Even 30 years on, in a radically changed society, their power is extraordinary. You find in them a combination of eloquence, insight, political passion, and political pragmatism. The Steve Biko Foundation is to be congratulated for keeping alive not only his memory, but also his principles. I shall try to say what some of the things that I've taken from his writing and from my reading. Steve Biko's definition of black consciousness, and I don't quote here, in the fewest words, as I understand it, would be self-respect, pride in one's own people and culture, and above all, self-reliance. He said that blacks in South Africa must look to their own efforts to achieve freedom, not rely on the assistance of other groups. And he said that blacks must never be complicit in their own oppression. He was quite uncompromising on this. He had hard words for those such as Kaiser Matanzima, who took office in the so-called Bantu homelands. As a student at the University of Natal, he'd been active in the National Union of South African Students, which, as you all know, is a body which was strongly opposed to apartheid and whose white leaders had often attracted the attention of the security police. Yet in 1968, he led a breakaway of black students from NUSAS to form the South African Students Association Organization. Now, his writings at this time show that he did this with no ill will towards NUSAS. His thinking was epitomized in what became a slogan, "Black man, you're on your own." Much of his writing and speeches continued to be addressed to young people. His message, tough as it was, militant as it was entirely free of rancor or expressions of racism. Speaking immediately after the death of Steve Biko, Bishop Desmond Tutu said that of all young blacks involved in working for change, he was the least infected by racism. So here then was Steve Biko, a true youth leader with not merely political insight, but with idealism and principle. It would be sad if such a man and such an example were to be forgotten. Now that much which Steve Biko lived and died for has come to pass, his words, strangely, have not lost their relevance or their resonance. His forthright analysis was that the struggle in South Africa was not a class struggle, but a racial one. He said that on the one side, racism was white racism, and that the antithesis to this must be ipso facto a strong solidarity amongst the blacks. But, he said, out of these two conflicting situations, one could hope to reach some kind of balance. His words were, "A true humanity where power politics will have no place." And he concluded one article with words which I should like to quote. He said this: "Blacks have had enough experience as objects of racism not to wish to turn the tables. While it may be relevant now to talk about black in relation to white, we must not make it our preoccupation, for it can be a negative exercise. We have set out on a quest for true humanity, and somewhere on the distant horizon, we can see the glittering prize. In time, we shall be in a position to bestow upon South Africa the greatest gift possible, a more human face." He did not live to see the end of that quest or to have that glittering prize within his own grasp. So this evening, we remember Stephen Bantu Biko, his life a South African beacon, and his death a South African tragedy.